Thank you, Mr. Schneider, for very interesting talk. I'm going to put off questions on this talk until after Professor Tullock has talked. I think even though the talks are on quite different topics, I think it'd probably be better to handle it this way. It's a real pleasure for me to introduce our next speaker, Professor Tullock. I think Professor Tullock is absolutely unique in the academic world. And I thought of this when I was going to say what kind of an education he'd had. He's a professor of economics. He doesn't have a PhD in economics. He doesn't even have an MA, although today that would be damning him with faint praise. He doesn't even have a major in economics. He's an undergraduate. Yet he's gone all the way and is a professor of economics. I know a few other economists who don't have their PhDs and have done quite well, but I don't know anybody who has a record like this. When I first knew Professor Tullock quite a few years ago, I already had my PhD, and he said he thought he might be thinking of leaving the State Department and getting into academic work, and I told him again and again, I said, you've got to get your union card, you've got to get your PhD. He refused to do it. He's not the kind of person that will take the normal route. Now, he's written so many things. I'm not going to say very much about many of them. I don't think there's any question that his work with Professor Buchanan, entitled The Calculus of Consent, is probably his major piece of work. I'm sorry I can't recommend it to you to read. I find it one of the most difficult things that a professional economist can get entangled with. There's another book that he's written that I would recommend called The Politics of Bureaucracy, which is not nearly as technical, and I'll guarantee that if you haven't read it, you'd find it an entertaining and enlightening book. Today he tells me he's going to talk about a subject that will probably go over the heads of most of us. The title is The Role of Ideology in Public Goods.
I shouldn't have. The fact that I have said that should have been kept a secret from the audience. I should say that although it's perfectly true, yes, Camp was quite right, I didn't get a degree, etc. In a way, nevertheless, he's responsible for anything that I have done in economics because my first publication in economics was a joint article with Professor Campbell, and he actually wrote it. So this got me started. I could maintain, since I have had an article published or half an article published in a leading economic journal, you know, it was sort of, even if I didn't have, well, at the time you were at Chicago, at that time the University of Chicago was maintaining that an article in a leading journal was acceptable as a PhD dissertation. So, you see, I through his kind assistance, I was well on my way. When I was first asked here to come and give a paper, the subject was the welfare state. Is it reversible? I agreed to come and talk about this subject, but I said I didn't know what the answer was. I was therefore not terribly surprised to discover when I received the program that I was scheduled to talk on a different subject, and a subject which, I take it, gives me very great freedom to say almost anything I want. It happened I was doing some research at the time on a problem which seemed to me of interest, but perhaps too technical for this audience. I confided my doubts about Professor Campbell. My colleague, Mr. Buchanan, however, said that he thought the Philadelphia Society was quite capable of following technical material, so I decided to give the matter a try. And we will find out as it goes on. If I understand it, the basic problem faced by the Philadelphia Society is the fact that the average American intellectual has a set of ideas about the world which most members of the Philadelphia Society regard as wrong. Further, the dominant intellectuals, which I regret to say does not include anyone here, through their control over most of the media of communication, are able to impose a good deal of their view about the world on the common man. Although it must be said that the common man shows signs of not being quite so easily fooled as the intellectuals. The basic problem I am concerned with is how general ideas of various sorts do get distributed through society and widely accepted. The traditional method of study in this field is a history of ideas. a subject which in some cases is taught as a separate discipline or as separate courses at any event. Normally, this involves an account of the way in which some idea gradually spread and was adopted. For some obscure reason, most research of this sort has been carried on in the fields of literature, philosophy, political science, or economics. Recently, there has been more interest in such history of thought in other sciences, but there's still a concentration in the fields I have mentioned is clear. It is clear that there's a marked difference between the development of thought in the scientific fields, in which I would include economics, and that which we find in literature and philosophy. Nevertheless, at the moment, there is no real theoretical system which can account for the spread of ideas or their persistence in society. If we wish to change existing ideas, a wish which I think is widely held here, it is of some importance to learn about the mechanism which leads ideas to be accepted, to spread through society, and to maintain themselves in the public mind. For some time, I have been attempting to solve this problem, but I must concede that so far I have not done so. What I have been able to do is get little bits and pieces of theories relating to this subject. There are, for example, four chapters in another one of my books, Toward a Mathematics of Politics, which I think offer a contribution, albeit a rather minor one, to this problem of the theory of idea dissemination. This afternoon, I'd like to present another scrap of such a general theory. More specifically, I want to present a minor theory which deals with certain aspects of the spread and maintenance of ideas in a society. If we look at the real world, we observe that there are widespread ideologies which dominate much political life. The secular humanism is not very well worked out, but I think we could count it as an example. And I might add that most of us have another ideology ourselves. Further, almost without exception, these ideologies are based on little or no evidence. If we move from the political world to the economic world of the market, we observe that ideologies are largely absent. It is not true that all people engaged in market economy are careful with calculators and that they do not have illusions or make mistakes. It is not even true that we do not occasionally observe a large number of people buying something under the same mistake, which would be much the equivalent of a political ideology. Nevertheless, it is clear that, generally speaking, we do not have much in the market that corresponds to political ideology. Why this difference between the political and economic spheres? It is my contention that economic theory of the public good provides a rather simple and straightforward explanation. Since a theory of the public good is associated in many of your minds with Pigou and Samuelson, you may regard this as a left-wing approach to the problem. It is true that public goods and the general theory of externality was originally largely dominated by people who were politically on the left, but has recently become a main source of interest to great many people who are politically on the right, including myself. And I don't think, as of now, you could regard it truthfully as a left-wing branch of economics. But regardless of its current political associations, the theory of the public good can be applied to the problem of dissemination of ideas. Let me begin by considering some person, let us say a judge in the federal court, who has two problems before him. The first of these problems is the purchase of a new car. The sentence is sentencing in a criminal case. Suppose that the individual has always in the past bought Buicks, and that he believes that criminals are sick and deserve treatment, not punishment. I think that most of us would agree that under these circumstances, if we observe the judge, we would find that, in spite of the fact that he has always in the past bought Buicks, he would look at other cars, talk to friends who have other cars, and in other ways solicit information as to whether or not this year the Buick might be a poorer buy than some other car. On the other hand, when it comes to the criminal case, his sentence will normally be informed by his ideological view about criminals being sick and requiring treatment rather than punishment, and he will not make any effort to canvass the possibility that this theory is incorrect. I should say parenthetically that I've been doing research on a particular area of crime, and there seems to be a total absence of empirical evidence that criminals are in any sense sick. As far as I have been able to determine, the conventional wisdom is not based even on bad empirical investigation. It is based on no empirical investigations at all. But perhaps some of you can call my attention to some empirical investigations I have so far overlooked. There may be something, as a vast literature, it's conceivable there's something that I haven't found. Well, why do we observe this difference? I suppose that most of us would agree that in a real sense, the decision on the criminal is probably more important. It will affect the personal life of the accused, and it will also probably affect the personal life of a number of other people because he either will or will not commit further crimes as a result of this sentence. But if we look at it solely from the standpoint of the judge, the reverse is true. If he buys a Buick and it turns out that this year the Buick is a lemon, he will pay the cost of that mistake. The car won't run as well, nor be as attractive as it otherwise would be, and the resale value may be lower. On the other hand, if he makes a judicial decision under mistake, the net effect on him is almost zero. Let us suppose, for example, that he carries his basic theory to extremes and releases the criminal in return for an agreement to visit the psychiatrist twice a week for 6 months. Presumably, the result of this would be, assuming his theory is incorrect, which is an assumption I'm willing to defend, that the national crime rate would be slightly higher than it otherwise would be. The discounted effect of this on a judge, however, will be trivial. Surely his decision in this case will have only the slightest effect on the national crime rate, one man, and a trivial increase in the national crime rate is unlikely to mean that the judge himself be the victim of a crime. Putting it in the modern economic terminology, the judge in deciding to buy a car is purchasing a private good for himself and is well advised to invest resources in deciding what he should purchase. In making the sentencing decision, he is creating what we call a public good, and he is well advised to do what he does, which is to give relatively little effort to find out whether his information is correct. In both cases, he is making a correct present discounted assessment of the value to him of the information. Suppose, for example, that the judge has currently a feeling that Buicks are good and that crime is a result of illness and should be treated rather than punished. Let us suppose that his feeling with respect to Buicks is not very strongly held. He would feel some slight injury if he were forced to change his mind, but a very small amount. Let us measure it as $2 or $3, just in order to have a number. On the other hand, probably his views with respect to ideology are more strongly held, but nevertheless, let us assume here also that the pain he would necessarily undergo in educating himself about the subject and finding out that he was wrong and had been wrong in previous decisions, which probably would make him more unhappy, would be only a few dollars. It is nevertheless true that the gain to him out of his decision would probably be less than a few dollars in the judicial case and be much more than a few dollars in the Buick case. His behavior will make only a very small difference in the crime rate, and that small difference, although it might add up to $100,000 in additional robberies for the coming year for the nation as a whole, is unlikely to affect him. In fact, his share of that $100,000 increase in robberies as a result of this particular decision, assuming it's spread all over the United States, is only 0.05 of 1 cent. Clearly, then, not taking the psychological cost of the change of mind is a sensible course of action on his part. It is true that he put the public interest above his own interest, which I'm sure he would say he did. He would spend more time and energy on making his judicial decision than on his decision to buy a car. But we do not observe very many people who actually do this, as opposed to people who say they do it. Samuel Johnson remarked, "The public disaster never puts a man off his breakfast." There's been technological progress in public disasters in these days, and perhaps that's no longer true, but it certainly is true that most public disasters don't. But let us generalize a little bit. Let us suppose we have a person who has some ideology with respect to political matters which will have effect, if it has effect at all, only through government activity. He can be a bureaucrat, a professor teaching his course, a reporter, or somebody on TV whose opinion will affect the voters, or he can simply be a voter himself. If he has now some particular point of view on some subject, the gain to him from discovering that this point of view is false and changing it is, generally speaking, trivial. The cost to him in psychological terms can, on the other hand, be quite sizable. In the first place, he will have to spend time learning that he is wrong. The members of this society, living in a country where their point of view is relatively weakly held, are continuously exposed to the opposite point of view, and I think many of you, like myself, take positive steps to make certain that we know what the other side is saying. Members of the liberal establishment, however, are not automatically brought into contact with points of view different from theirs, and very, very few of them make any effort at all to find out what the other side is. A student I had last year, when I suggested he read the National Review, said that he found out what the conservatives in the country thought by reading what liberal professors of political science said they thought. Granted that improving, by the way, I may add that as a result of what I regard as my beneficent influence, he now maintains that the reason he doesn't read the National Review is that our library doesn't carry it and he can't afford it. This is progress. It may be not very much progress, but it is progress. Granted that improving public policy is a public good and that the psychological pain of feeling that your present position is a little uncertain is a private pain, this is a very sensible position. It would not be sensible, however, in dealing with some good which you are going to privately purchase when the cost of the mistake would fall on you. Most of us are aware of this and therefore do put a good deal of attention in deciding what particular private good we will purchase. More, of course, with more expensive private goods than with the cheap ones. It is not, however, solely the problem of changing your mind or of obtaining information which might indicate that you are wrong. Painful though both of these items are, or at least they are to me, there is also the problem of social relations with others. Public acts of a sort which have effect on public opinion will automatically be brought to the attention of a number of other people. If there is now in existence a general orthodoxy, or simply if all of my friends happen to believe one particular point of view and I choose a radically different one, there is an immediate problem in my social relations with them. It is not necessarily an insuperable problem. I may be able to convince them, but for a period I must anticipate that a number of my friends will go around saying that I am crazy, that I will have bitter arguments not of a purely social nature with them, etc. This again is a purely private cost, and the gain which I would have from selecting a more rational ideology, one which is based on the actual evidence, is a public gain, and very little of it will redound on me. It is true that if I were able to convince everyone else that I was right, and in fact I was right, I might obtain a significant gain from it. But there are very, very few of us who are in that position. If I am extremely persuasive, normally, I could convince a small number of people and hope that if other people were doing the same thing at the same time, the net effect would be to change the policy of the country as a whole. Still, in all of these cases, I would be suffering a short-term private cost, and the net effect of this cost on others would be a very slight advantage to me. I might gain from the fact that other people were arguing for the truth, but the net contribution that any one of us would make in this case is very small. As a rather eclectic bit of empirical evidence on this point, I should say that I not infrequently have in my classes students who have conventional views on most matters. Granting that they have a high enough IQ to understand complicated reasoning, which is sometimes the case, I never have any great difficulty in changing on their minds on matters where there is, in fact, a good scientific argument against conventional liberal positions. The reason for this is simple. I can ask them questions about the matter in class, and they are compelled to answer under conditions where a foolish answer may cause them private losses because of what the other students will think of them. Further, even if they don't agree with my position, it's highly desirable for them to become familiar with it, because I might ask a question about it on the test. I should explain, I always tell my students that they are quite free. That when I'm asking questions for which I've given a definite proof of something, in part in tests, you know, you ask them to recapitulate what's going on in class, but they're quite free to put a statement in saying, I do not agree with the following line of reasoning, but it is as follows. I suppose it'd be a little nerve-wracking to actually do that, but anyway, at least in theory, they're quite free to do that, and I must say my students do disagree with me violently on other matters, so I don't see why this difference would come. Learning how the line of reasoning actually works, then, is a private good in these cases. Needless to say, these private benefits from learning an argument which is inconsistent with a basic position do not exist for the average person who is not in the classroom situation. Thus, we have what amounts to a test of the hypothesis, and the data supports it. I would not like to argue, however, that this little subjective story is a definite and conclusive proof of the matter. If any of you can give me some money, I think I could set up a nice statistical test, but it would be expensive. So far, I have argued that the economic theory of the public good explains why so much error persists in public discussion of political matters as compared to the amount of error in the economic marketplace. One of the outstanding characteristics of political discussion, however, is not merely that errors continue in existence for very long periods of time, but that new errors are continuously created and sweep the country. Indeed, we even find cases where truthful or advantageous ideas are incorporated into the existing ideology. How can we explain this? Here again, I think the theory of the public good is very helpful, but we must make a few additional assumptions about personal preference functions. I would like to add two special arguments into the individual preference function, particularly of people who like to think of themselves as opinion leaders. The first is that they do not like to repeat exactly the same thing over and over again. A certain amount, or I think not a great deal, of variety is attractive to them. Marshall McLuhan once said that a publisher had rejected one of his books because it was to a considerable extent new, and the publisher thought that the ideal book was 90% existing information and 10% new. We need not accept this figure exactly, But I think it's something like this exists, and for purpose of illustration, I will use his percentages. Assuming then that most people would like to hear a good deal of repetition of things they already believe, a sort of ideological sermonizing, but some new things. Thus, the ideas that appeal to them most will be basically similar, but to some extent different. Metaphorically, 10%, if we use Mr. McLuhan's percentage. Secondly, let us assume, which I think is correct, that most people who are opinion leaders like to be with it. They like to be leaders in whatever is going on. They like to be spreading the existing fashion. They do not, of course, like to be different other people in a way which is not the way for the future. People in this position would obtain some private benefit from a new idea which was slightly different from the existing orthodoxy and which looked as though it might be the orthodoxy 3 or 4 months from now. Once again, the public good aspect of the matter, whether the idea is correct or not, is something to which they should give little attention, and the private benefit which they would obtain from the pleasure of a slightly different idea and the pleasure of being a leader would be of more importance to them than the public good. Thus, new ideas, which are somewhat but not radically different from the existing orthodoxy, can, if they get a proper start, sweep public opinion. And this is what we observe in the real world. In many ways, the reasons for a particular idea becoming very popular in intellectual circles and the reason why dress fashion change are the same. The mechanism would lead to a random walk with respect to the dominant ideas in society, but would not lead them remaining the same. Here again, this is what I think we do observe. This discussion has been a rather discouraging one. I've argued, using what I think are quite good economic tools, that ideology are subject to a number of conditions which will make it quite hard to improve them, if we have some idea of what is meant by improving. It may be, however, that there are other factors operating which make improvement not quite so unlikely. It may be, for example, that people are attracted to truth, play truth. Clearly, this is not a dominating factor in political discussion, but if even a small factor, then the random walk would gradually lead in the direction of improvement. Secondly, it may be possible, once we have understood the process, to influence more rationally than the people who do not understand the process. For example, let us assume my theory is correct. It would follow that the average political idealist would have no motive to learn about this theory, whether this theory was true or false, because it would be a public good. And hence, we would have what would amount to secret information as to public opinion formation. Thus, if there are ways of applying it, it is almost a self-kept secret. We need no security. Even if it were readily available, copies of the books were in all libraries on this subject, most opinion holders would not be motivated to read these books or to learn this additional information on opinion. Those people who did learn the new tricks would have a distinct advantage. But this, of course, assumes something which at the moment is not true, i.e. that we can make use of the theory which I present today for the purpose of generating public goods for ourselves. At the moment, there is little in the theory which would lead to this conclusion. Nevertheless, it seems to me that learning more about the way ideas are disseminated is an essential first step if we are to become effective in disseminating them ourselves.